and then also ActionAid, who, when I described their book yesterday, described them as fighting disaster capitalism around the world, and they really do that, and I've relied very heavily on their incredible research, so I feel really lucky to be here with them and to have witnessed this incredible exchange over the past couple of days between the delegation from India and Lopez here in New Orleans. It's particularly humbling to be introduced by Bill Goodwin, who is a hero of mine, and for many of us outside the city, listened to him on Democracy Now! And read his dispatches, and it was really a reality check about what was going on in the city from the very first dispatches from the cell phone in the hospital where Bill was unable to leave and working with patients during the disaster itself. And it's particularly, it makes me nervous, let's just say, to talk about these issues to such an amazing group of people, because I research and I write about disaster capitalism, but there are people in this room who not only have lived through the disasters, have been victimized by disaster capitalism in very, very real ways, lost their homes, lost their livelihoods, but in the midst of that have organized others, showed that it is possible to stay oriented in the midst of tremendous trauma and shock. And analyzed it on an ongoing basis. So they didn't need experts to come in and say this is going on, but we're living it, educating, organizing, and naming and analyzing simultaneously. So that is truly humbling. That's a truly humbling audience to speak to, so you'll forgive me if I'm a little bit nervous. I'm going to start by showing a short film. It's just 6 minutes, and you guys are the first people, the first audience, anywhere in the world to watch this film. It's going to be released at the same time as the book. And it was made to go with the book by a wonderful Mexican director named Alfonso Cuarón. Some of you know his name, and I think a lot of you probably know his work. He made Y Tu Mama Tambien and Children of Men, which is a futuristic sort of dystopian film, and that's how Alfonso and I met, because he told me actually that my writing about disaster capitalism had in some ways influenced the vision of the future that he had portrayed in Children of Men, where you had inside and outside people with papers and people without papers, and it's a very frightening vision of the future. But the movie that most of you might have seen that made Alfonso famous is the third Harry Potter movie. The best Harry Potter movie. So this was sort of a gift, this film, from Alfonso. I sent him the book to read, and he just decided to bring his team of filmmakers together, the people who work on his film, to reinterpret this idea of the shock doctrine and disaster capitalism, and come at it from an artistic point of view, not just, you know, my book has 100 pages of footnotes, and I explain and I argue, but they just took these ideas and made something, I think, quite powerful with it. I want to set the film up a little bit, because it's quite disturbing to watch, I think. And the reason for that is it deals with themes of torture. It deals with themes of torture because as I was researching and thinking about this idea of disaster capitalism, this mechanic of taking advantage of societies in their moment of the deepest trauma, when they are entirely discombobulated, don't know who and what they are, have lost their story, have lost their footing, and using that moment to take from them that which they would have protected otherwise, that is disaster capitalism. And I started realizing that there were very powerful parallels between that collective process of disaster capitalism and what happens in the interrogation chamber, in the torture chamber, and in fact what happens even in the normal incarceration process in this country, which is a system of putting people into a deliberate state of shock, a dehumanization process. And I started reading all of these manuals, these CIA interrogation manuals that were declassified thanks to Freedom of Information requests in the late 90s. where they talk about this as a science, the science of taking an individual and regressing them, putting them into a state of shock, putting sensory deprivation, isolation, sensory overload, inducing that state of shock. And in that state of shock, when they are regressed, they start to see their interrogator as a kind of a father figure. A father figure, this is in the text of the manuals. And so that was the idea that Alfonso and I tried to bring to life with this film. I don't want it to shock you, and that's why I set it up. And I think that's all the setup it needs. So we're going to roll this very short film, and I will be back. Caught the attention of the CIA. The agency funded a series of experiments. Out of them was produced a secret handbook on how to break down prisoners. The key was using shock to reduce adults to a childlike state.
It's a fundamental hypothesis of this handbook that these techniques are, in essence, methods of inducing regression of the personality. There is an interval, which may be extremely brief, of suspended animation, a kind of psychological shock or paralysis. Experienced interrogators recognize this effect when it appears, and know that at this moment the source is far more open to suggestion, far likelier to comply than he was just before he experienced the shock.
But these techniques don't only work on individuals. They can work on whole societies. A collective trauma, a war, a coup, a natural disaster, a terrorist attack puts us all into a state of shock. And in the aftermath, like the prisoner in the interrogation chamber, we too become childlike, more inclined to follow leaders who claim to protect us. One person who understood this phenomenon early on was the most famous economist of our era, Milton Friedman. Friedman believed in a radical vision of society in which profit and the market drive every aspect of life, from schools to healthcare, even the army. He called for abolishing all trade protections, deregulating all prices, and eviscerating government services. These ideas have always been tremendously unpopular, and understandably so. They cause waves of unemployment, send prices soaring, and make life more precarious for millions. Unable to advance their agenda democratically, Friedman and his disciples were drawn to the power of shock.
The subject should be truly awakened and immediately blindfolded and handcuffed. When arrested at this time, most subjects experience intense feelings of shock, insecurity, and psychological stress. The idea is to prevent the subject from relaxing and recovering from shock.
Thank you. Friedman understood that just as prisoners are softened up for interrogation by the shock of their capture, massive disasters could serve to soften us up for his radical free market crusade. He advised politicians that immediately after a crisis, they should push through all the painful policies at once before people could regain their footing. He called this method economic shock treatment. I call it the shock doctrine. Take a second look at the iconic events of our era, and behind many, you will find its logic at work. This is the secret history of the free market. It wasn't born in freedom and democracy. It was born in shock.
Isolation, both physical and psychological, must be maintained from the moment of apprehension. The capacity for resistance is diminished by disorientation. Prisoners should maintain silence at all times. They should never be allowed to speak to each other.
There's one other thing I've learned from my study of states of shock. Shock wears off. It is by definition a temporary state. And the best way to stay oriented, to resist shock, is to know what is happening to you and why. Powerful feeling of of people occupying someone else's home and changing things around. But in Iraq, the violence is overt, right? I mean, they're driving around in armored vehicles, and the mercenaries have guns out the windows, and it's clear that it's an armed robbery. No one's pretending otherwise, really. But here, it's an armed party. It's a very different feeling, but it is an occupied city. It feels that way. That New Orleans has been the victim of a kind of a home invasion on a mass scale. Now, the ultimate irony of this looting of the public sphere that took place in the aftermath of Katrina is that the disaster itself, as so many people have said and re-said, was not a natural disaster. It was a disaster of the economic model that we were just discussing in the film. It was a disaster of the ideology that is espoused by people like Milton Friedman that advocates starving out the public sphere and subsidizing the private sphere, although they don't say that publicly, but that basically vilifies any kind of public spending and deregulates all forms of capitalism. And Katrina was the logical, it wasn't Katrina, the breaking of the levees and the disaster that followed, the failure of the transit system, the fact that that the idea of disaster response and evacuation plans was handing out a bunch of DVDs, the absent government, as Paul Krugman called it, the can't-do government, the hollow state that everyone saw when people were waiting, where's the government? And the government just wasn't home. You know, it was revealed as a kind of a mirage. That was the disaster. But the irony was that the so-called reconstruction was this process of finishing the job, of looking at the last sort of tattered, decayed remnants of the public sphere and going after those in the name of rebuilding the city, the housing projects, the hospitals. So that is, of course, disaster capitalism. And you know, we are seeing this now. You know, another phrase that I've heard a lot over the past couple of days is that there are many Katrinas in this country, and this has been kind of a summer of them, with the bridge collapsing in Minneapolis and the steam pipe explosion in New York, and the subways in New York flooding after not very much rain. And what was interesting about these smaller scale disasters, obviously not in a comparable scale to what happened in the city, it was also a result of a crumbling infrastructure, and in some cases this very powerful collision between this frail and decaying and brittle state after 25 years of steady neglect, meeting heavy weather. So you've got the weak state meets heavy weather, and we have and the emergence of these kind of a new kind of neglected urban landscape, which I think we should be thinking of as kind of a mold belt, right? Where we used to have the rust belt in another stage of capitalist abandonment of cities, when the factories left, you know, whether they moved south or they moved to Mexico and then they moved to China, and they left behind these sort of decayed, rusted landscapes. Now they're leaving behind molded. After the bridge collapsed in Minneapolis, the Wall Street Journal immediately called for what? The privatization of the American road and bridge system. That's disaster capitalism. That's what they've learned from Katrina. They said, obviously, the state can't do it. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? First you neglect the state, you weaken it. And most people's only reaction with the state, with the government, is with the police, in a negative relationship. And then you come in and you say, well, see, the government can't do anything. We better get the private sector in here to help it out, right? So, okay, well, maybe we'll have to have higher tolls. So what does that mean? We think about what happened in this city. Then you're really looking at a kind of a disaster apartheid system where it's not only just the people with cars, but you have to be able to pay the tolls on the bridges to escape the disasters that are being created by this economic model. And when those subways flooded in New York, the New York Sun ran an editorial, I think it was 3 days later, Sell the Subways. Sell the Subways was the headline on the editorial. And they advocated privatizing individual lines of the New York subway system and having them compete against each other. And they said, you know, people will use the lines that where they invest in the infrastructure. I mean, it's laughable, but but this was actually proposed. Invest in the lines, and then you can ask, you can charge higher rates, and the lines where people don't invest, you know, they will just be underwater, and more people will use the other. Now, what this actually means is Upper West Side and Brooklyn Heights has their lines directly to Wall Street, and the lines that service the Bronx that are already a disaster, that are already decaying, basically drowned. Right? This is another example of disaster capitalism, but it's another example of this self-fulfilling prophecy. And I'm Canadian, as you've heard, and we're facing a similar slow-motion version of disaster capitalism, where our public health care system, which is really the pride of the country, and is really what Canadians say, make them different from the United States. It's a core part, it's not just a public service, it's a core part of our national identity. No politician can run on a platform saying, I've got a great idea, let's privatize the Canadian healthcare system and use the American model. That's how you don't win. So everybody promises to protect it, but then they starve it until it just becomes so frustrating to use the system that anything else seems like a good alternative. And of course, when it comes down to people trying to find health care for their parents and they have to choose between a two-tiered system and a lousy system, people immediately make those choices. You know, and it doesn't feel like a selfish choice. It feels like taking care of your family is what it feels like. It actually feels like a selfless choice. I had an extraordinary experience when I was here in New Orleans, which I was debating whether or not to tell this story, but I feel like it really cuts to the heart of what we're talking about here, because disasters, we had a discussion earlier today, and talking about how you, if you don't like disaster capitalism, if you don't like what is being proposed, you have to have an alternative, and you have to have a vision that goes deeper than just a different kind of disaster response. It's about a different kind of society that you want to build. And I had this experience when I was here 10 days after the levees broke. The city was still partially flooded. The lights were out, and the traffic lights were out, as well as all the other lights. And the street signs, many of them were twisted up. And I was driving with some friends in a rented car, and I wasn't personally driving, I should say. We got into a pretty bad car accident because there were no traffic lights, and people were driving really fast. And it was one of the people in the car is here. I haven't seen him since we were in the hospital together. John Clarity. He wasn't driving either. We got into a T-bone collision at pretty high speeds. And we spun out. Nobody was seriously injured. But there were fairly minor injuries. And my memory of this was being strapped to a stretcher and having a minor concussion, and I was taken to an ambulance, and all I could think of was, wherever they're taking me, I don't want to go. All I had seen were, the images that we were seeing all the time, the charity hospital and the airport. Don't take me to the airport, But I didn't realize that there were hospitals that were not in that kind of shape in New Orleans. So I'm saying to these guys, they were paramedics from Florida. They had no idea where they were going either. And I'm going, I'm fine, just let me out. And then I passed out, and I woke up, and from what I could tell was a spa. As a veteran of the Canadian healthcare system, this seemed to me to be the spa at the Hilton, from what I could tell. I learned later that it was the Oshner Medical Center. I was attended to by a fleet of healthcare professionals. From what I could tell, Jordan and I were the only patients in this place, which was extremely odd, considering we were at ground zero of the largest public health emergency in recent history in the United States. Three nurses took me to get an x-ray. I had a senior doctor and a resident to attend to my three stitches. And then a very nice nurse administrator came in, and she said, I'm very sorry. I need to ask you to fill out this form. We pay for health care here. We're not proud of it. We wish we had your system. And she meant it. Now, we were ready to go within an hour or so, but And I have to say, in Canada, I wait probably four times as long to see my general practitioner than I waited to get treated in New Orleans during this healthcare emergency. And we could have left, but the problem was the curfew was still on, so we couldn't actually leave. So we were sort of stuck in this hospital with a bunch of bored security guards who they told us were guarding the pharmacy from the junkies. And so I just started interviewing people because I was frustrated that I couldn't leave. And I started talking to the young intern who was treating me. And I asked him, he was just fresh out of medical school, young guy. And I asked him what it had been like during the hurricane. And he said, oh, I wasn't on duty, thank God. And I thought that was a strange thing to say because he was such a young man and he was, you know, one would think that if you've just gotten a medical education and such a disaster lands on your doorstep, you'd want to work. And so I said, well, you know, was your family okay? And he said, well, I actually don't live in the city, so we were outside the city, we were fine. And I said, did you go to any of the shelters? Because I knew that's really, at that point, when people were out of the city, that's where the real health emergency was. And it was clear at that point that it hadn't even occurred to him to do that. He was just watching it on TV like everyone else. And I think, when people like Bill tell us that, this is a fast-forward disaster, the daily disaster, what we've heard from so many people here in New Orleans is that there already was a disaster. There already was a humanitarian disaster in this city that we just suddenly saw when the city flooded. I think this is really an example of it, this mentality of this young intern. And it really cuts to the core of what kind of alternative society we would want to build, other than this disaster capitalism, is the kind of society that trains a young doctor to see on a day-to-day basis the poor, uninsured people of this city as not his patients. If he can do that on a day-to-day basis, then when disaster strikes, it's really not that much of a stretch to continue to see them as not his patients. He felt bad for them. They just were not his patients. They were not his problem. So that, I think, cuts to the core of what it is we're talking about, which is, do we think that every life is worth the same? If we don't think so during normal circumstances, we are not going to think so during disasters. We want to tell ourselves that we do, that disasters are special moments where we become a lot nicer. And I think that there are, that we do see that impulse, right? Where, with the outpouring of charitable giving, that suddenly people are shocked and they say, this is not us. We are not the society. We want, all lives are equal and we demand some kind of a change. What I'm afraid of is that as these twin disasters, the slow motion disaster of the erosion of the public sphere, collides with climate change, and there are more and more of these collisions and these fast forward disasters, then we're going to see more brutal responses from the haves against the have-nots. That maybe we'll look back on that generosity that was inspired by the tragedy here in this city, almost nostalgically. That moment where there was this outpouring, and people said, no, that's not us. And the future will look like, there's an airline company in Florida that launched on the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. It's called HelpJet. HelpJet is a private charter air service that targets itself to the wealthy in Florida, and they say, turn your hurricane into a luxury vacation. When the hurricane comes, HelpJet spots it. They let you know. You're a member of HelpJet. You pay your dues. They contact you. They say, where do you want to go? The Caribbean, Disney World. They book your holiday. You go to the airport. They say, avoid the line, avoid the hassle, and they whisk you off, right? This is a disaster apartheid system. And unless we get to this core issue of whether all lives are worth the same, then we are going to see disasters be not moments where we come together and feel good about ourselves, but moments of very radical stratification. And that's what this impulse that we saw with the bridge collapse, okay, let's privatize the bridges and raise the tolls, You know, let's just have good highways for the people who can afford it and let the rest of them rot. Or let's have, you know, two subway systems in New York. This is what we're starting to see. It's a very clear pattern. And I don't think we can just address it in disaster moments. We have to get to the core of what's behind it. Now, I referred to what happened in the city as kind of an armed robbery, and I saw some of it when I was here the first time. I was at the legislature in Baton Rouge, which had sort of opened itself up to a lot of the corporate lobbyists who didn't have access to their offices. They actually moved into the state legislature and would have morning meetings with the politicians, and there was so much excitement. In that moment, there was this open talk. Everyone was talking about clean sheets. Do you remember this? It was the famous quote from actually, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce his name right. Joseph Cannizzaro, is that how you say it? One of the city's wealthiest developers who said, "I think we will have a clean sheet to start again, and with that clean sheet, we have some very big opportunities." Now, you hear this a lot from disaster capitalists. You know, you heard it from the architects of the war in Iraq. The idea, you know, we're gonna build a model state. You know, Iraq will be like a clean sheet. And I think it tells us a lot about who we're dealing with. This desire for blankness. I actually thought about calling my book at one point "Blank is Beautiful," because it's the animating dream of the disaster capitalist. And what is the dream? It's to get rid of the people who are causing so much problems and hinder their dreams, their dream fulfillment, precisely because the policies that they'd like to advance are so fundamentally unpopular. I mean, this is the deep lie at the heart of the story we're told about the triumph of Reaganism and Thatcherism and this sort of extreme form of total market domination. We're told that we wanted this, that we asked for it. And what we see in their attraction to disasters, the fantasy of the clean sheet, is their own admission that they can't impose this agenda in normal, non-cataclysmic times, precisely because people get in the way with their silly ideas and their desire to protect their schools and their hospitals and their communities and their housing projects. So non-cataclysmic times are inhospitable to this project. And so they need disasters in order to impose such an unpopular agenda. Now, you can see that very clearly in Iraq, where it's absolutely blatant. You have the Shock and Awe invasion, a military project that was overtly designed to put an entire population into a state of shock. If you read the Shock and Awe manual, it talks about the difference of this military strategy compared to the first Gulf War, was that the first Gulf War targeted Saddam's army, and this targets the, quote, population writ large in an attempt to overwhelm their senses with the incredible power of the U.S. military. That is the strategy of Shock and Awe. It is torture on a mass scale. Immediately following up that Shock and Awe was Paul Bremer riding in the city still on fire and pushing through the most radical economic shock therapy program ever attempted, completely rewriting the economic architecture of the country, flinging it open to foreign ownership, and of course that backfired. But when it backfired, and when the resistance rose up in Iraq, then there was the third shock. The first shock was Shock and Awe. The second shock was economic shock therapy, and the third shock was the shock of torture, was the rounding up of thousands and thousands of Iraqis. And they brought the war into the jail cells. And this triple shock formula, what I argue in the book, is that this is what I'm referring to and what Arundhati is referring to as the secret history of the free market, that this triple shock formula has been there all along. And that this fairy tale myth of this ever having been democratic or consensual, it was just simply never the case. And it's true that there has been it's true that the shocks are getting bigger, precisely because the resistance is growing. So in the 90s, this agenda advanced through the shock of structural adjustment. In the 80s, it was debt shocks a lot of the time, market shocks. That disciplined countries that tried to deviate from the Washington consensus. it was arm twisting at the World Trade Organization. It was the coercion of the International Monetary Fund. And as people got organized and as started resisting these methods, then I think you start to see this sort of gloves off disaster capitalism of exploiting natural disasters and riding on the backs of preemptive wars. But that wasn't entirely new either. Hurricane Mitch was exploited for a wave of privatization in Central America in the late 90s. And if we look back at the history of what a lot of economists or left-wing economists refer to Milton Friedman and his crusade as a counter-revolution against Keynesianism and developmentalism, third world nationalism, that this was, it wasn't a battle against Marxism and socialism so much as it was an attempt to undo, in this country, the New Deal, and those forces that were mediating this pure vision of capitalism, that were inserting elements of socialism into a capitalist system, a public school system or a healthcare system, the public safety, the social safety net that was demanded after the Great Depression. And that is what the counter-revolution has sought to systematically dismantle, and I think you see it most clearly in this city, where it's just this laser-like precision to go after what is left of that dream. One thing that I find really interesting, Milton Friedman died in 2006. His very last piece of public policy recommendation before he died, his last foray into politics, if you will, was an op-ed he wrote for the Wall Street Journal 3 months after Katrina, in which he said that, I'll read this to you. He said, most New Orleans schools are in ruins, as are the homes of children who have attended them. The children are now scattered all over the country. This is a tragedy. It is also an opportunity to radically reform the education system. He was advocating the wholesale privatization of the school system of this city. It was his sort of farewell speech, if you will. And it was a fitting farewell because this idea of exploiting crisis was really the core idea of his career. And you saw the quote in the film, only a crisis, real or perceived, produces real change. And that quote goes on to say, when the crisis hits, the change that occurs will depend on the ideas that are lying around. And I think of many of these think tanks that descended on this city, they're kind of, it's a form of intellectual disaster preparedness. Right? Some people stockpile canned goods. They stockpile free market ideas. And we saw this September 13th, 2005. Immediately, the city was still partially underwater. There was a meeting at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, one of the most influential right-wing think tanks in the country and the world. And they stayed up very late into the night. They had a group of very powerful Republican lawmakers with them, and they came up with a list. It's called 32 Free Market Solutions for Hurricane Katrina. And the first one was suspend Davis-Bacon, the prevailing wage law. The third one was what was to give parents vouchers so that their kids could go to charter schools. Another one was drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Preserve. I mean, just go for it, right? That's shameless. I think I'm running out of time, and I want to have a good... We're okay? Okay. What I do in the book, and I don't have time to do justice to it, is look again at these key moments, which were the moments when this free market agenda had a leap forward, starting in Chile in 1973, where Milton Friedman acted as an advisor to Augusto Pinochet, the dictator, and also a large group of students, of Chilean students, who had gotten scholarships from the U.S. government, from USAID, to go to University of Chicago and learn free market economics. This was a very deliberate policy of the U.S. government. You know, it's often sort of blamed on the University of Chicago, but it really was a Washington's policy. It came from USAID because they were worried about the emergence of what they called the pink economists, the pink economists being the developmentalist economists in Latin America. And Santiago at that point was really ground zero of developmentalism, which was an alternative to this radical free market capitalism, but also it was an alternative to totalitarian communism. It was the real third way, not the Tony Blair third way, but the real third way between these poles, and was seen as very, very threatening. It was threatening to U.S. economic interests, particularly because nationalization of key resources was at the center of the program. In Chile, the nationalization of the copper mine. So there was this meeting between the head of the University of Chicago Economics Department and the head of the Chile project for USAID, where they talked about what to do about the pink economists. And they came up with this bright idea of sending Chilean students to go to University of Chicago and study under Milton Friedman and the rest of these very radical free market economists who at that time, and now we're talking about the late 50s and the 60s, were really marginal in the United States. Did not have access to the halls of power in their own country. And Milton Friedman was constantly complaining about how they were a bunch of exiles and no one listened to them and everyone was Keynesian at that time. But they were used as an intellectual weapon against Latin America, the training of the Chicago boys. They went back to Chile and tried to win a battle of ideas, and they lost. They lost terribly, and Salvador Allende was elected president because that's what Chileans wanted in 1970. And then they returned with tanks. Then they imposed their ideas with tremendous violence. So that was the first laboratory. In Chile in the 70s, if you look at that list from the Heritage Foundation of their 32 free market solutions, basically Chile did them all in the 70s. They were way ahead of their time. 15% flat tax, charter schools, privatized Social Security. I mean, if you look at Bush's platform, they did it in the 70s in Chile. So obviously this was a violent way of imposing this project, and everybody recognizes that. But what I would argue is that the same thing happened, perhaps with more or less levels of violence in many other places. Argentina was another where the economic model was imposed with terrible brutality, the disappearance of 30,000 people. In China in 1989, the Tiananmen Square massacre was really the shock in that country that paved the ground for economic shock therapy. And Milton Friedman was an advisor to the Communist Party of China at that point as well, 8 months before the Tiananmen Square massacre. So we've been living this lie of the peaceful triumph of this ideology. And I think it's because we don't know this history that we are surprised by the level of violence that is now required to continue this project and to take it into its next stages. In Iraq, in New Orleans, even this using harnessing the shock of September 11th in this country to privatize the military, to build this wholly privatized infrastructure economy called the War on Terror, which is hollow, which is itself hollow, and it was the dislocation after that shock that as we know allowed the Bush administration to hoard power in the executive branch. What we've looked at much less is that they didn't hoard it for themselves. They took it and outsourced it and privatized it. Now, earlier today we had a discussion in which Saket Soni from the New Orleans Worker Center said something that I love, and I told him I would be quoting him forever now. He said, if they have disaster capitalism, we need disaster collectivism. And I think that's a wonderful phrase and a wonderful idea for us to hang on to as we think about these mechanisms. And I'll give you my interpretation of disaster collectivism, which is not some idea that we need to hole up in our think tank and come up with our 32 socialist alternatives to hurricanes and wars. For me, the idea of disaster collectivism would be based on principles, not solutions, principles of community participation, of local control, participatory democracy, the principle that every life is of equal value. Now, once you start from there, that means that the solutions can't be imposed either from the left or the right. I mean, if you say that it, that what's important is the process, that people who are affected by these disasters should decide for themselves how they want their communities to be rebuilt, what the priorities should be, what kind of societies they want. If democracy is at the very core of what you're talking about, then you can't, it's a contradiction to say that you have 32 solutions already. Now, I know that this idea of disaster collectivism is possible because I was fortunate enough to have seen it when I was in Argentina with my husband Abby when we were making the take. Now, this was this moment where the economic model was the disaster. It completely collapsed at the end of 2001. People lost their life savings, and the entire infrastructure had rotted at that point, had been outsourced, had been privatized. And you may remember some of the images of people storming the banks and pots and pans in the streets. But what was so incredible about being in Argentina in that moment after the economic crisis is that, I guess because the sort of attention of the world media was elsewhere, was on Afghanistan and then Iraq, the NGOs weren't there. You know, it was just the people. And there was this outpouring of grassroots disaster response, that the state had failed, that everyone who was supposed to help had failed. And so people spontaneously organized hundreds and hundreds of neighborhood assemblies, block by block. You'd walk around Buenos Aires at night, and there were meetings on every street corner. They were immediately doing disaster problem solving, setting up barter systems, setting up soup kitchens, setting up local health clinics, free clinics. It was like common ground, you know, many, many, many times over throughout the country. And something else that happened is that because there was so much capital flight, just like here where you had all these boarded up businesses, the businesses just left, that the workers decided to occupy their old workplaces and run them as cooperatives. Now, what was so amazing about this, when I think about it now in contrast to disaster capitalism, was that it was really the antithesis of the idea of the blank slate. The disaster capitalists want to wipe everything out. They want their clean sheet that doesn't exist. And they get so angry when it doesn't exist. They have to like scrub and scrub and scrub until they, you know, create ever more violence to reach this unattainable dream of blankness. You know, in Argentina, this spirit was not starting from scratch. It was starting from scrap. It was starting from whatever sort of garbage capitalism had left behind, just picking up the pieces, whatever rusty tools, whoever was there, and trying to put it back to work in a more just way. So I guess I'll end there with that idea of disaster collectivism and not starting from scratch, but starting from scrap. And then I think that maybe the world is divided between the people who think the future is shiny and those of us who know that it is rusty and moldy.